Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to the Dolcezza Server Experience on Full Service Radio, friends. We are live at the Line Hotel. This is Violeta Edelman, your host, and I'm here with my partner in crime,
Rob Duncan, Dolcezza Gelato.
And we're talking today to Lee Davis. She's a multimedia artist and educator. And Lee was intrigued by the complicated relationship we have with death and grief. And she decided to explore end-of-life experiences working with a variety of media. So this is going to be very interesting, people. Hi, Lee. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming. So tell me more about your work. How did you get interested in the modern rituals surrounding death?
Well, it's a succession of experience, death. So once you lose someone, you really understand death more. So I would say I've had about 3 or 4 very close people pass, and the last one was my father. And during that time, I had this absolutely phenomenal experience with him when he was in hospice. And I sort of didn't think it was real at the time. And I spent a lot of time with him and in the room when he was dying, right around the time of his death, this room filled with this incredibly luminous golden light that I'd never experienced. And it wasn't sun or anything natural in the environment. It was something completely other. And at the time, I sort of just held it in, and it was very healing and wonderful. And once I knew he was gone, it completely disappeared. So I had that experience, and I was thinking of it, and it really actually helped the grief of that death. And later, it was about 2 months later after he passed, I was in Baltimore, and I was commissioned to do a project as part of MICA's curatorial program. And part of the project was working with churches and congregations to make community-based work. And I was in this attic kind of area of a church, and I was drawn to this light. It's the same exact golden light. And it just felt too unreal that it wasn't some sort of communication. So after that, I started to do a lot of research, which is a big part of my process, and interviewing people in the world who study phenomena, and then just hearing different stories and accounts of these kinds of things happening. And it was opened up a whole body of work.
That's amazing. So it's very, very personal to you.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2013, so it's been a long time. I would say I was pregnant at the time, which is very important. So right when my father had passed, I was about 8 months. And then the month, after he passed, I gave birth. And so that transition, that circle was always very, very there as well. So I would say I did research for maybe 2 or 3 years into the subject, going to conferences and just diving in. And then I started to make work.
From the initial experience with the light at your father's passing, and then looking into it and going to conferences and talking with people that are looking into the phenomena of death and passing and all that, were you surprised what you learned when from going out there? And what was the thing that surprised you the most once you started looking into it a little bit?
It was based on a curiosity, not really knowing, which I think is a really good place to start. And I was so amazed what kinds of experiences people were having. Not only the people who are with the dying, hospice nurses and doctors watching the people who are actually dying having visions and things, but the people in the room who are very connected. And to hear the accounts and to feel validated by them, and to understand that we don't actually know that much about consciousness. That's what really opened my mind, and it's unanswered, which is why I'm interested in the work. These are questions that are unanswered, and we can't answer them, And that's clearly why I keep doing this.
They say that.
Tell that to religion.
Right. The opposite. The
they
opposite.
Think they know.
Yeah.
Right. The opposite of religion, which has provides its box of answers for all these unanswerable questions.
Yes.
Where really, it seems to be from talking to people and one's own experience is truly, 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 the true answer is nobody has any clue into any of it, no matter for how long they've been looking into this, at least in the Western side of things. Since the Greeks started rapping on the shores after saying, no more fishing here with these nets, let's start talking philosophy and really looking into this, the basic questions of where do we come from? Where do we go? What is life all about? And it's true. And it's 2,500 years later, we still have the same unknowing into these areas of reality. And like you said, consciousness. What is consciousness? What does it mean to be? And there's no answers. I mean, we're it seems like we as a people and science, we're now starting to go into that that area, which I think we'll learn a lot by going into it. But it's still something. It seems like it is the mystery of its being.
Exactly.
And I mean, and I don't know if we can come to any. We can learn. And remove misunderstanding and stuff. But I really don't know if it's something that we as humans, recently evolved monkeys, can actually come to an understanding of that. If you then look into the, I guess, the context of the situation, the fact that we're on a planet in a galaxy, how many stars are in this galaxy, the Milky Way, then how many galaxies are in the known universe and inside, you know, it's just like the situation that we're in is kind of like impossible to fathom from the human perspective, it seems. So
I want to ask you, so that we give it some frame of work, what exactly are end-of-life experiences?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
So I actually took the term end-of-life experiences spans a lot of different ways of dying, but the term that I'm taking is called the ELE, which is a commonly... And it's taken from this neuropsychologist that I met at a conference who's involved in my film and who's just an incredible researcher. His name is Peter Fenwick. And basically, he has a sort of list of things that occur, particularly during a death. And death itself doesn't actually... The concept of dying actually can happen a week before someone is gone, in a sense. So a week or two, sometimes before the person doesn't have a heartbeat and... supposedly is gone, certain things can start to happen. So the person who's dying can see visions. They can have dreams of people visiting who are past. They can see light, and different kinds of coincidences with animals and birds will come. So there's all these things that can happen both to the dying person and to the sitter or the carer who's with them. Strange light is a big one, golden light.
That's the one you experienced.
Yes.
To those things, is it common? Is
yes.
it rare? Is it like 50-50?
It is very common, and this is sort of why I did the research. And people have been studying them and doing studies, and mostly in Europe for many years. Yes, it's very common. And the thing that you brought up earlier is that this is throughout cultures and time periods. I mean, people have been sharing these experiences forever. So it's once you start to link all the things together, you see, oh, this is common. You see it on... cave drawings, you see light, you see things happening. So visions, I'm trying to think of other ones, eerie, sometimes the atmosphere will feel different, just sensory things. Sometimes people will feel someone. So there's different ways, and there's a huge list of them. You know, I have most of them in my film, which is just...
What about those people who die for a couple of seconds and then come back?
Oh, yeah. I'm interested.
The near-death experiences,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's actually funny that you asked, because for the first, I would say, 3 or 4 years of working, I was really focusing on death before, during, after. And now, because it just brings you to another place, I've been interviewing people who've had these near-death experiences, and they're kind of making their way into the work. And a lot of people, when they see it, can't manage that part. It's really interesting when I show my work to audiences that are not really comfortable with death. particularly the afterlife. Exactly.
You know, as Westerners, I think in the Eastern world, you know, they focus very much into preparing you for death, even mm-hmm. in some religions, and it becomes sort of the center of their lives, letting go, and there's all these rituals around it. But mm-hmm. in the West, we very much deny
it's material. We're materialists.
Yeah. So
and death has. Yeah. We can't take our stuff with us, so we don't want it. We got to hang on
that's actually,
to our toys.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of doing this work is not just, you know, clearly I'm interested in it and I can do it. There's so much there. But when I have conversations around my work and I have Q&As, there's such a feeling of people have really strong opinions about this work because it's bringing up all of these things that they haven't really managed to deal with. Or really interested in, or just completely against. And it's why I make the work. I mean, part of it is the conversation about it.
Yeah, yeah. Also because if you think about Western religion and how it is used, you know, and this concept that we were talking about this yesterday with Rob, that your soul is going to go to hell if you don't, you know, do the right thing. So in a way, death has been used to tap into our worst fears and oppress us. So yeah. So there is this whole, like, dark cloud that we have, you know, that we've been taught that, you know, it's not good unless right?
Where do bad folks go when they die?
They don't go to heaven.
Where the angels fly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen people who have no belief. This is the other thing. I've seen people who have no belief, even my father, not religious whatsoever, at his deathbed. Looking to God because they're terrified.
Yeah.
And it's a very...
I'll never forget this Tibetan Lama that we had known. And he was one of the real Tibetan Lamas that, like 5 years old, his parents, he was taken to a monastery in Tibet. And that was his beginning of mm-hmm. like meditation and I guess that way. Then they escaped when China came in, and they escaped to Dhamsala in India, and then he's made his way to upstate New York and was there at a retreat center there. And we would go up there, and we had some friends up there and retreats and stuff, and I'm always interested in that. And remember having him say, no matter what, for all of us, people who have been studying this and practicing for our deaths for our whole lives, even it's going to be hard no matter what. That letting go of everything and then the transition into the great unknown, no matter who you are, how practitioned you are, you know, how much you've really worked on this, it's going to be hard. And then I've heard other people talk about it as far as like it's just for all form to give up its form mm-hmm. at the biological level, you have resistance, mm-hmm. you know. And so it's really interesting. It's something that's been at least very present in my life for a long time, not in the morbid way, but I always thought about death. And I thought specifically about at that moment in time, if I have the luxury to see it coming, right? What is going to be the most, what is really going to matter to me in that moment in time? And then it's always been this thing of like, can I try to live my life somewhat aligned to that? Because it just seems like most of us, We live our life chasing everything that's frivolous and it doesn't really matter, but we put so much time and energy into that where at the end, 99% of all that stuff that we valued and thought was important really doesn't matter. It's you know, it's who you love, it's who's loved you. Those kinds of things are really all that matter, but yet we waste our whole life and we really don't do that until the very end. It would be kind of cool if we could kind of bring some of that back into the now when we actually have the time and the energy to look into that and to try to find out what's going on. Like
well, you are creating a conversation around it. So,
yeah.
So you're doing that.
It's really about love, and that's what all the work's about.
Yeah.
I mean, because what you're saying is exactly why I'm so drawn in and why this interconnectedness between all of these kinds of experiences is really about connection from before, during, and after, whenever. So it's... all of it is about love. And I know it sounds, you know, like one word, but basically that's all the work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And why I'm drawn to it and why people react so strongly. And but what you're saying is very clear to me.
And I mean, it is like also growing up, obviously the West has this phobia. It's like this, it's kind of like sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, death. It's like nobody talks about it. No, you can't really talk about sex to anybody because it gets all. And I always said, like, no. It's
Your next project?
Yes, sure.
Yeah. Well, new language reveals a lot about a culture, right? And I know from learning Spanish and all that, it always fascinated where in the English language we first stuff like the body parts, you know, the genitals. We have either the medical word for it, or we have the vulgar word for it. There's not just the normal word for it, where in Spanish there is that. And it's not, and it's, I always picked up on that, where, so going back way deep in our language, we can't talk about it.
Yeah, no, it's very,
you know,
true.
And so if you can't talk about it, you can't establish a relationship with it. Mm-hmm. And that is what it's all about, establishing relationships with it all. That's kind of like what I think is the main thing we do, is being alive, trying to have, and then have a healthy relationship, whatever that means, with it. We can't even do that with food, or let alone sex, drugs, rock and roll.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
There's a book called Being with Dying that I recommend. It's written by a monk. Her first name, I don't remember her name. Halifax is her last name.
Yeah, Joan, right?
Yeah. It's wonderful. And it's just that thing about being with the thing that terrifies you, or the thing that...
Right.
And it's so clear, but I think I did a lot of hospice training just to face death in a really deep way. And I sing with this choir called the Threshold Choir, and we sing to the dying at bedside. And that's a separate kind of work for me, but it's so much about being close to dying, and really, and that's also a fear, just to be with someone else going through something so hard and deep, and to just sit there and be
just your
and
presence,
to let
right?
all of your stuff outside the room and walk in and just be completely present. That is
just that's deep. Enough work,
yeah,
as it
I mean,
is, right?
Just,
to be able to sit with it.
It's really changed my life, actually, and I would never have done it.
Wow, when you say this. The singing. The Tibetan or the Buddhist, it's like they have this thing, Om Mani Padme Hum. When to repeat for the mantra for when one is dying, they say, I think it's to help them in the passage to
of the bardo
of the bar through
That's
the bardo
it.
And all
mm-hmm.
that. It's really
the transition.
It's fascinating.
But
it makes
they believe
it makes,
in reincarnation, of course.
Yeah. Right.
So for
right.
them, it's just if you live a good life, then your next life it's gonna be more of full of compassion and love, right? Like you were saying, otherwise you're going to suffer more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole premises of karma, right? Do the good deeds so that in the next life you're not a little insect or
squashed on a sidewalk.
Yes.
Under a shoe tread.
Right.
So with the time that you've spent looking into this and all that, what do you think? What do you think about it? Like, I mean, in a nutshell, it's a deep subject, but what do you think happens at death? So obviously our version here in the West is we go to pearly gates and golden roads and Yahweh is up there sitting on the throne and that's heaven, right?
Right.
And I think that's the version that we're...
Or science, saying like...
It's over. Existential curtain comes down and the show is over and nothing ever meant anything
dust
here.
To dust.
If it did, it was inferred upon it, Mm-hmm. So, there is the science of existential bleakness kind of thing, and nothing is nothing. Or the Western Christian
version. But science
version.
Says now that, energy is always here.
Yeah, but they're staunch, but that has nothing to do with the human experience. They're talking about, smashing atoms, and that's not that doesn't translate to the human experience. It's still a kind of a bleak vision. And they even say that all of life has no meaning whatsoever. All of evolution is a random walk mm-hmm. of mutation. So it has no purpose, theology. There is no purpose whatsoever in any of life. No, and that is the position of science. So with you around all these people and hospice and dying and researchers and stuff, I mean, kind of like, what have you learned about it? Like, what's your take on all of this? Because no one knows.
Yeah, I've been completely shifted through this project. So first I am sort of a skeptic in a lot of ways, which is partly why I do it. And if I wasn't a skeptic, I think it wouldn't be the project that it is. But the more people I meet who are in the field, who I trust, I deeply believe that they're really onto something, is that the dying process itself is a state of consciousness different than us sitting here. So even when you're about to pass and your body is shutting down, you're already on your way to another state. And that is, I think, a kind of hint to a state that we don't know anything about. So I believe in that. And I believe that there's a lot within us that we aren't, that we don't have access to until the end of our life. And I can't really put a word on what that is. It's a state of consciousness that we can't access.
Okay, so that feeds right into the next thing that I want to ask you, and that happens to be why you're sitting here, right?
Yes.
Is there, we don't have access that to that while we're alive. Psychedelic use, right? There's a lot of research that's been going on for millennia. I mean, it's like the ancient use of plants with tribes and cultures and all that. Now here, there is a renaissance of psychedelic research happening in NYU, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, and more, looking into this phenomena as far as like what does that experience say about death, maybe, and having people come to terms with their death if they're dying. And it seems to be, it's all speculation, but it seems to be that there, through those experiences, which I've heard people say is kind of like a dress rehearsal for death, it sheds light on that experience, which is, if that is the case, it's unbelievable if that's the case that these tools exist that are now Schedule 1 illegal and people get locked up for. And that, you know, it really is really, so have you talked with researchers in that area also?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that.
So I went to a conference in 2013 where the NYU doctors were there, and that was the first time I'd heard about these studies that were being done. And then I've read all kinds of articles, and of course there's the Michael Pollan book, and now it's sort of becoming to the surface, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Particularly if a writer like him can write a book, Pollan, it just brings it to the surface.
Pollan's voice changes it for everybody.
And that's a good book. I mean, I read it, and you know, it's definitely interesting to hear his take on it. But when I heard these doctors talking about these studies, it was years ago now, you know, and that was the beginning. And definitely these were shifting people's ways of looking at their own death. And that just there, just in terms of people facing it, explains what I'm talking about, where they can access another part of themselves through psychedelics, through a trip where they feel safe, which again is part of this mentoring and leading and being in a room. You know, if you haven't experienced drugs before, and you don't have the experience, I think it can completely shift the way you think about yourself, your body, your disease. And so to access that and to have them come out of those experiences with no fear of their own dying feels completely worthwhile and useful. So yes, I think there's something going on, and it's just going to become more and more prevalent in our culture. And clearly it's working. Whatever is happening with these studies, there's more and more being done. So I feel like it's coming to the surface, and I think it's a really good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wholly believe in people creating those experiences for themselves or finding someone to lead them. I have a friend I just met here in D.C. who did a study at Johns Hopkins about meditation and psychedelics. You know, just the fact that these things are happening says so much about what we don't know and we're trying to figure out.
You know, I applied to one of those at Johns Hopkins for psilocybin.
I couldn't believe
and they
she
wrote
did
back
it.
That I had too much experience with the
she
subject.
Had some
so
too.
I was like, damn it, this is like play. I wanted to try it in a clinical setting just to see what it was like.
What she said, though, which I feel is very important, is that most of the other people didn't have experiences in the past, so it was mind blowing. And I've done many psychedelics, so it's different for me, but I can imagine, as an adult with an already lived life with the fears and everything going on, just how it could shift. And you face it. You face those fears during those trips.
Tell me.
Short break before?
Yeah.
I just want to say we're talking to Lee Davis. She's a multimedia artist, and we're talking about death. So,
goodbye.
We'll be back in like 3 minutes.
We'll be back.
Yeah. come back to the Dolcezza Sherbert experience. Yeah, I have problems with that word sometimes.
Sherbert. Yeah, she hates that word in the name.
I don't hate it, but it's Sherbert, a little hard for me Sherbert. To pronounce. But you like weird names.
I know. Sherbert, the language weirdo.
Anyway, welcome back to the Dolcezza Sherbert experience. We are live at the Line Hotel on Full Service Radio.
Line Hotel's easier to say.
It's easier to say, yeah. They're simple.
Simple folk.
Not really, but we're talking to Lee Davies. Let's go back to our interview for a second here.
Okay.
Yeah. She's a multimedia artist, and she did her last project was about death and grief and how we deal with end-of-life experiences. So you guys were talking about psychedelics. You can go back to that.
Yeah,
or
so Lee,
I can ask some questions.
Well, just kind of, maybe we'll get to your questions. But
all right. I'll wait.
If I do. If I may. So you said you've had an experience with psychedelics. Could you share a little bit of that? Because I love talking about drugs with people.
I think drugs have really formed my identity as a young person. So, but I also grew up in a place where there were a lot of drugs, you know, just available.
That was in Manhattan? Or?
No, I grew up in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And, you know, I sort of was in high school. It was just, we just did drugs all the time. And I think that at that moment...
Me too. You too.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that I stopped doing them when I went to college and started studying art. I sort of had a phase where I was like, I've done all the drugs.
We had the same phase.
Yeah.
4 years.
Yeah.
Completely clean.
Yeah. But I think, peyote. I mean, just I remember those experiences as informing me as an artist too, as the way that I imagine the world and make meaning, and. See, so you know, I feel like they're a big part of who I am inside, and I still have yet to do ayahuasca, which is something that I'd really like to do in the right setting.
Well, if you ever we have the right setting for, I mean, down in Peru and Brazil, with some of these people.
Yeah, so I'm interested in the altered states and how we change, how we're constantly changing anyway, living, but through them and visions. And visions are such a part of. The work I'm making too, even when I hear someone's stories about a drug trip or about dying, or I mean, I'm such a visual animal that I create those images in my mind and then I can make them. And there's something really just delicious about doing it that I'll always do. And so with this kind of experience where you can't take a picture of it, that's so great. You can't document this. As an artist, it gives me this amazing freedom to create whatever things come into my mind, and they're out there, and it's fantastic. So that all of it interests me.
So it's been very like informative and the use like psychedelics on your life. You know, it's like I said before, Bielet and I met 20 years ago at one of these kinds of things, and even before that. Because of some experiences that I had that changed me forever, you know, and continue to inform me now, 20 years later after experiences, which is not a joke at all. It's like still trying to figure out.
Well, the ultimate goal of when you drink ayahuasca is to face your own death. I mean, that's the ultimate goal, and to let go of the ego. So there is a direct relationship, you know, there.
Yeah. And you were saying that, so when you talk about this stuff to people, I mean, I guess if you're at a conference and you're talking to people, then you're going to have a reception from the audience because they're all there, right? But like outside of that, do you find, how do you find people respond to this subject as far as do they reject it? Are they receptive overall? I mean, I know both is the answer, but.
Yeah, both is the answer. And it's so much about what it really does is it shines a mirror on people's experiences. And so... I feel like people, again, are either in resistance, in resistance to letting go of the ego, which is what dying is, and which is what some of these experiences are, and just not feeling comfortable without that shell. So I feel like there's just two audiences, really. And that's why I do it, because I want both audiences, and I want the people who have the shell to kind of think about themselves after they leave, even if they can't discuss it or... acknowledge whatever we want to talk about. But I feel like there's such a different it goes both ways. And that's what makes, and there's so many people and everyone's dealing with the same thing. So it's so universal. There's no way to, everybody's talking, everybody has a connection to this.
Can you talk to me about the process of creating this archive of afterlife experiences?
So I've just been doing interviews, really, probably like this for, I've stopped doing the interviews now because I'm creating this sort of filmic essay. It's an animated film. And I've shown it a couple times in spaces and art spaces, and I'm just going to start finishing it this spring, really. So you'll get to see it, I hope. But basically, I've been meeting with people who want to share their stories with me, either online, on the phone, in person, and I record them, and then we talk about the experience. And sometimes it's the first time they've ever told anyone this thing about their life, and it's also usually one of the most meaningful things that's ever happened to them in their life. So someone being around death where they've seen someone come back to life, or they've seen blue smoke, or they've had this crazy coincidences. I mean, they've never told anyone because they're ashamed. And that part of it, I feel like, is really important for me to be the listener. And then I take the story and I animate it. I create images around it with the audio track. So it, what's working for the film is that when people watch it, they really feel like they're in someone's inner space because there's a lot of sound. It's not too much, but there's all imagery, and get into it. They feel like they're in the space I'm trying to create, which is the space we're talking about, instead of like, this is what's going on in a documentary style. It's
so
not my
funny
style.
How you say that. And looking into all this subjects for a while, and always saying that how limited we are with our verbal language, with our spoken language, to try to tell you through words what I'm experiencing, it's such an inefficient way to do it by telling you that. Because you have your own set inside your head that hears it and translates it into the what I'm talking about. Whereas if I had a way of putting on a VR head mount to you of a vision that I created, animated, then you could understand a lot more of what I was talking about. And that's really cool. That's kind of what you're creating, and it sounds like it's resonating. So that it's a much more powerful way of communication is the visual more than the auditory.
I think
which
so
is fascinating
too.
To hear you say that.
And it's very intimate. The stories that are being recorded, I mean, are incredibly intimate stories and very emotional. But what I also feel is important with death, and you know, I'm not morbid at all when I do this work, but that it's not too emotional, that there's humor, that there's sort of trippy aspects, that you're sort of going in places that are really strange and surreal, and that it's sort of has all these emotions in one thing because it's full of all those emotions. And so I really try to put in some humor and some things that kind of trip people up so they don't get too deep in.
Yeah.
Because I don't want it to be that either. So it's really been fun, and I'm obsessed with it, which is great.
But
I also need to finish it. So that's a good feeling to have.
But you've also visited shrines and altars, and you've interviewed a bunch of people that, you know, like religious leaders and hospice as well, people who work as I can't even
chaplains.
I'm like,
and
blah. So there is this whole other aspect to it, right? That you've explored deeply.
Yeah. A lot of
and
Buddhists
that goes into different
to?
Works. I mean, this one work is ELEs, and then I do all kinds of other healing works about grief and dying contacting spirits. Like, I love all the work that comes out of this research. It's not just one project. I mean, the Buddhist
contacting spirits. Oh, come on!
No,
I talk more about it.
Let's channel right now, okay?
Okay,
who we got? Who's coming in today?
You think it's funny, but
no,
I don't. I went to.
No, we're making fun like you are, but
no,
we like it.
No, we are cool with all the seers and the oracles and the street corner prophets.
Okay,
we're down with that. We're kind of like
we love it.
That's who
we
are.
I want to talk to a spirit.
I believe in after death communication, which is basically when someone comes to visit you in the form of a bumblebee. Who's my father, who visits my children, in the form of light, in the form of a song playing at a certain time, which makes meaning, perhaps, is a grief response, or it is real, I don't know. But I was doing research in Long Island, New York, met this family who runs this organization called Forever Family Foundation, which is about the study of consciousness after life. And I was like, I'm just going to go here, and they have a radio show, actually. But I went to their basement and I was photographing and gathering field work, I call it. And they had this thing in their basement called a psychomantium, which was this sort of black curtained off space that they had built out of PVC pipe. And I said, what's that? And they said, oh, that's a psychomantium. We use that to contact our loved ones. And I said, oh, that's...
I want to talk to my dad right now.
No, and I was, you know, I'm like, oh, that's crazy. Ha-ha.
Through PVC pipes.
But,
wow.
Yeah. And so I went inside and he explained it. And, you know, these people are very research heavy. And I said, oh, that's interesting. So I planted a seed in the back of my mind. 3 or 4 years later, I'm in a show in New York now. And the show is about collective grief. And it's a real wonderful show. And so I said, I'm going to build a psychomantium in my vision of what it would be. And so I built one. But I built a huge pyramid made out of moleskin. And you can enter, and you can basically, what you do is a practice called mirror gazing, which you've probably heard of in meditation. But mirror gazing is when you sit in a reclined chair on the floor and you look in a mirror, and the mirror is angled so you can't see your own reflection. You can only see a kind of reflective surface. And you come back to the Greeks, actually. It's the idea of the oracle. And you look in and you try to see someone or think of someone on the other side, and be it contact them or not, the awareness of thinking of a loved one that you know, have connection to is what that space creates. And it's really amazing because, you know, it's in a show in New York, it sort of has, it's part of a conversation, but when people go inside of this white gallery and they go into the space, they have, what they do in, is they come down into a kind of present space that they wouldn't be in outside in the street, or and
I'm
it
sure it's very emotional.
Wow.
It is emotional, and people can bring things and leave them. So I'm interested in these experiences, creating them physically and then creating them to sort of get people on to that space that we're talking about. I don't know if that's making sense.
Yeah, yeah, it does.
100%.
Totally.
And we need more of that because, you know, we don't have
We have no more of institutions of that, meaning like the shaman, the elders, the wise men, wise women, the oracles, the seers, the soothsayers, whatever. You know, it's like those people who basically, that's kind of what they do. I mean, it's worse. Any of that, any notion, any conversation of that today is so, it's not respected at all amongst science, amongst the people who make the beliefs of our reality. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like those experiences are extremely, extremely important in the making the model of reality, as far as like just the questions that we all have, every person on the planet, is what does it mean to be human? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the sexual experience is an existentially important experience to know what it means to be human. Very differently, I say existentially important, meaning that it's not like riding a bicycle or learning a typewriter. You know, that doesn't really impact and tell you much about like what the importance or what it means to be human. Where the sexual experience, the birthing experience, the dying experience, the falling in love, those are all extremely important, where if you had not had that experience, you know less about the dimensions of humanness. And I feel like psychedelic experience is one of those fundamentally important experiences for the building of what it means to be alive. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and then especially with the plant base, you know, because what does ayahuasca mean? It's a Quechua Indian word that means vine of the souls or vine of the dead. You go and talk to any of the rainforest shamans or the rainforest Amazon people, and what they say is you go to the land of the past ancestors, and that's where you learn your magic. You learn the weather for the next week, the where the game is moving to hunt or to cure the sickness of the person there. So it's like they, in their culture, they completely have no problem with, we go to the land of the past ancestors.
And you ask for advice, you ask
right.
for guidance.
And we learn stuff that we bring back to here, and we use that. Where here, for us, hearing that is like, look, if you believe that, you know, you need to see a doctor. We'll prescribe you some medicine so you no longer feel that way. And if that doesn't help you, I have a straitjacket over here waiting for you, and there's some asylum way up on the hill that we'll never hear from you again. Thank you very much. And tying into that is, I always heard some friends of ours who are researchers who have been looking into this a lot longer than we have. And they said a schizophrenic and a shaman are the same. one has scuba diving equipment, the other one doesn't, meaning that they swim in the same really deep waters that has access to the voices and to the visions and to the spirits and to the hauntingness, but the shaman can go down into those deep waters with his equipment and not lose it and see all of that and then come back and give that back to his people, where the schizophrenic doesn't have the tools or the techniques, and so it destroys them, and they can't function back here in society, but they're open to receive that, whatever that is, as well. And it's all about the culture. Does the culture support that way, or does it completely demonize it and cast it aside and see it as a sickness? And so if that's the way that the culture sees it, that's what it becomes. And it's fascinating, and it's so sad that that's the reality.
Well, I mean, you as an artist have also scuba diving equipment.
Right, the artist or the shaman, the schizophrenic, it's all kind of like the same group of people, the visions, the visionaries connected to some other unknown dimension and trying to bring it back.
And also having it's almost in service in a way. You know, you want to use the tool to create.
To help all the lost people.
That's what I mean.
Plato comes into the cave, and says, the shadows on the wall is not what reality is. Come outside of the cave, and they all look at him and like say, no. That's kind of what, it's a very good analogy to what this is, you know, saying that I've seen stuff. And just because the culture that you live in totally discards that stuff makes it damn maddening to believe in your own conviction against what the greater culture says and say, actually, no, this is very valid and pertinent information for my model that I'm constructing here, as opposed to just completely discarding it, which I think happens to most people.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, we believe them against our own gut intuition and experience, which is it's damn confusing to me Bialet and I talked about it before. It's like, even religion can make you go against your own biology, meaning like a virgin until you're married. You believe in a cultural, a set of ideologies as opposed to your own biology.
Trusting
to reproduce the species. It's really, they fucking hacked it a long time ago, and I want to do research to find out who the motherfucker was that came up with that hack and then put it into the textbooks. Original sin. Damn you.
To bring it more into a positive, you know.
I'm a happy person.
Ultimately, I think the work that you're doing is all about, you know, connection and love, like you said. Mm-hmm. And that is also part of our culture, and that's a dialogue that we're having right now and a lot of people are having, regardless of their religious background. And that's something that is common to all of us, and we can rise above whatever we've been told and connect at that level. And I think that's the dialogue that you're trying to have. So
it's a moment in time where I think it's becoming more and more evident that we do need that.
We need
help, right? Like we're like
we
losing our shit on the collective.
We need healing on all levels.
We're like
right now,
we're warring, we're hating, we're fighting. We can't even talk to each other anymore without, you know, we it seems like we do need help to, it's just like the patient's kind of sick right now, the collective patient of us, right, on this planet. I mean, turn on the news and tell me 30 minutes later if you agree with me or not.
Yeah, that's why.
So
this
maybe we need to look into like, okay, well, what could possibly help us, I don't know, become more aware of who we are? It's not really complicated. It's like what you said about the
pausing
ego.
Pausing a little bit too would help.
Slow down a little bit.
Yeah, it's a big part of it.
Yeah, look inside.
All you need is love. Love is all you need.
Yes, that's a good one.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Lee.
Oh, no,
really
it's great.
Great.
Thank
you
so much for having me.
Yeah.
I
and you tell her, like, do you have a website or anything? Like,
or
where we
when
can
is
find
your
out more for your film?
Yeah. What is the name?
The film is called Inquiry into the ELE. And I'm going to show it in Reston. There's an art center here. But I'm also going to show it in the fall in D.C. somewhere. I'm working on it. So, and I'm also going to do a work at the Congressional Cemetery, a sound work, in November. So I'm definitely getting into D.C. and going to do some work here. And you can find my website at my name, Lee Davis Projects.
Right on.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank
you so much
for having
me. Thanks for coming in and talking to you.
Yeah.
It was great.
See you next week. Be kind to one another. Actually, in 2 weeks. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.